right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Timothy J. McAvoy from Cameron McAvoy for Ronald DeCesar Jr. It's humbling to be here. It's humbling to follow counsel's last great act, as he said. To the justices of this honorable court, I don't think that there's any question that attorney's fees are one of the biggest challenges that are pressing against our profession in terms of access to the legal system, alluded to with the entrance to the bar this morning. Also with the amount of litigation or satellite litigation, which is not even satellite litigation. It's often fees litigation is part and parcel of many cases. Aloha versus QSP, I think an issue went to the jury. Many times it's bifurcated, the court decides it. In this case, we know from the case law of this court that the American rule is still alive and well, notwithstanding the General Assembly making inroads through statutory fee-shifting provisions. And also another rule which remains alive and well is the primacy of individual contracts. And this court has held many times in Dewberry and Davis versus C3NS, Aloha, Burger Busters versus Chawla, many cases make it well established that parties can strike their own private deal to change the American rule. And what this court and what other jurisdictions have clearly said is that if you're going to go down a contractual fee-shifting road, and here that's what we're dealing with, that's our setting, not obviously a statutory fee-shifting regime, the contract, it's a contract, and like all contracts, the fee-shifting elements of recovery become the law of the case. And so the principle that I think, or one of the most important issues that is before the court today, is notwithstanding what everybody agrees was the victory at the jury, from the jury by my colleague's client, Pilar Godoy's trustee, there was still a contract, and there was still a requirement that they meet every element of the contract to get a fee-shifting recovery, because that was the law of the case. And it was stipulated to on brief in this court and also at the trial level that the contract in question is unambiguous. That contract has four elements, and the first question presented is neatly presented by the trial judge, who said at Joint Appendix 3446, the way I read it, and I'm quoting, the way I read it, if somebody starts litigation to enforce this agreement, the prevailing party in that litigation can get his or her fees, unquote. And the error, the clear error in that statement, which again is 3446, is that there are four elements to the fee-shifting requirement in this case. And I mentioned the Dewberry v. Davis case. That was actually decided by Judge Terry Ney, who I just remember here this morning just because he was a dear colleague and I noted in preparation for today that he had decided that case and he had been the litigant in the Burger Busters case, the prevailing litigant. So it pleases me to mention him. But of the four elements, and if we look at Joint Appendix, I believe it's 107, is where the shareholders agreement appears. There's a prevailing party requirement. There's a requirement that a party initiate litigation to enforce the provisions of the contract. There's a reasonableness requirement, thank goodness. And then there's also this fourth requirement that even my colleagues have described as idiosyncratic in their brief before this court, which says that the fees have to be incurred in enforcing the contract or securing performance of the contract. So that phrase, enforcing or securing performance, occurs twice. And in this unambiguous situation, we know from many contract cases in law school, in fact.
Counsel, may I ask you this? Is it really unambiguous? I know that it's been stipulated to, and it's been argued, but that happens all the time, where one side says the contract clears the bell and I win, and the other side said, no, the contract clears the bell and they win. It's a question of law, if it's ambiguous or unambiguous. Judge Rausch, as I understand her reasoning, was decoupling the first clause, in the event a party to this agreement engages an attorney, from the remainder, the prevailing party. Now, that's an interpretation of that arguably is ambiguous as to what the prevailing party is referring to. But if she's right, and it's not inextricably linked to a party to this agreement who engages an attorney, then the attorney's fee award was appropriate.
I don't think she was right, if I may. When I was a first year, I worked for a gentleman named Ken Bass, who would clerk for Justice Black, And he quoted Justice Black to me and told me that one of the first things he learned from him was that if you use, and I'm not trying to be funny, or, but if you use an English word, different English words, they don't mean the same thing. Or if you say something twice, it's for a reason. And here, this fourth prong, if you will, that starts after after the reasonable attorney's fees on trial and appellate level, it starts with incurred in enforcing this agreement and or securing performance of the terms herein stated. If Judge Rausch is correct, then that whole last clause is surplusage and thus violates one of the basic canons of statutory or contractual construction that has been filed in this court forever. And in English law as well. So I disagree with her for that.
The syntax, according to the trial judge, is if any party, a party, hires a lawyer and files suit, comma, if that condition is met, the prevailing party, and under her reasoning, that could be any prevailing party, whoever is the prevailing party, plaintiff or defendant. It's not absurd. It may be strained, but it's not absurd.
I would agree it's not absurd. I do agree, though, it's strained, and I don't believe that the natural reading, if you look at the, we have to ask ourselves, why does this language appear twice? And if we look at other things that have been cited in the briefs and on the record, and have, in the court, notwithstanding the unambiguous nature of this contract, the case law also is clear that you can consider the context in which this contract arose. It was a closely held company where there was a desire to sell the company, and the record reflected that Ron DeCesar was afraid his mom and his aunt would change their minds. One can readily imagine that using the words enforcing and securing performance a second time was intended to allow someone who went into court to file a claim to compel specific performance or to allege breach, being the only party that would recover their fees because of the history of recalcitrance. Now, I don't think I have to go there again because... the function of a demur, for example, it's a gatekeeping function. I would suggest that the that clause one and two, the first two elements that you're alluding to, are the gatekeeping function. If anybody sues to enforce or to secure performance, any party to this, it doesn't matter if it's Blar or Eileen, the mom, or my client, that opens the gate. But then the secondary criteria...
It's not just any party. It's a party that is represented by counsel. But pro se initiates, which seems... Now, that does seem absurd. But if a pro se initiates, there's no prevailing party fee.
According to the plain meaning of this agreement. But I didn't negotiate it. My client and their clients did. And actually, there's support for that in the record. If it comes up, I can quote. But... We are all required to live with what's written here and use the normal canons of construction. And again, I don't want to belabor it, but I suggest that the second use of this language in context in particular, I believe, is what makes the reading that we urge upon the court to be easily the right one. I agree it's not absurd to read it the other way, but it is strained, and thus the natural reading is the one that Mr. DeCesar Jr. would argue today. So I think the other thing that gives me a lot of aid and comfort, actually, is the fact that the cases cited in our reply brief of the courts that have considered what does it mean to enforce or secure performance, no matter how we look, no matter how many times those words appear in this clause, just the meaning of those active verbs has been considered by other courts, and that ought to give, I believe, us comfort in holding that more is required than just being a passive defendant. It could have easily been the case that it said in securing performance, defending, enforcing rights, securing rights, and so forth. In fact, I'll point out that in the Verderbusters, Charleview Verderbusters, there was an attorney's fees clause that talked about recovery for a party enforcing rights, or I believe the language was to the effect of or exercising rights or privileges, something like that. It was something other than the exercising of rights or privileges, and I'm paraphrasing, was something other than litigation. It could be read as something other than litigation. And this court, in deciding the Verderbusters case, did not turn on the word enforcing. It turned on the fact that it viewed the prevailing party below, Judge Terry Ney's client, as having exercised rights. And you can see that. I can provide a jump site on rebuttal, perhaps, if I can see it in my 5 minutes, maybe reserve my time. I rely on my brief to the extent I didn't get a chance to argue anything. I would also rely on the case law that I cited. We didn't find contrary authority. To the extent we found contrary authority, it had idiosyncratic language that would broaden the entitlement to fees that is not present in this record. And I think that what's important here, and Judge Ney, in the Dewberry case, he was reversed because he grafted an equitable element on an attorney's fees contract. And this court said, you can't do that. You just have to interpret the contract. So while my colleagues are extremely able and got a great result for their client with the jury, they didn't fulfill the they couldn't. It's not their fault, but they couldn't fulfill the elements of a contractual fee recovery. And as fee litigation proliferates, I think it's important for this court to reiterate to litigants and to trial judges that if you have a contract that's going to change the American rule, you have to meet every element. And I know that's obvious, perhaps, but we see from the Dewberry case, we see from the case below, we see from other cases, that doesn't happen all the time. Litigants need to, just like a tort, you've got to meet all of the elements. You've got to lay out these elements and meet them, and that didn't occur here. So unless anybody has any questions, I would move for leave to save my time for rebuttal, and if any.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Bredehoff from the firm of Kaufman Knowles. With me in the courtroom is my colleague Mort Hornbeer, and at counsel table is principal trial counsel, who was admitted pro hoc vice below, my friend Mr. Gale, Leonard Gale from Chicago. This is an odd provision. We meet every part of it. I'm going to have to start with respect by disagreeing with something the justice said. The trial court's view of this was not a strained view because of the difference between the prevailing party and the term that was not used, that party. Let's look at what the clause says. In the event a party to this agreement engages an attorney to enforce the provisions hereof or to secure performance by a defaulting party, well, that happened. The prevailing party in litigation shall be entitled to an award of reasonable attorney's fees. It doesn't say that party. If it required to have a fee award only to the plaintiff, it would say that party, the party that initiated the litigation.
But if that's true, that means your client could not recover prevailing party fees if the suit had been initiated pro se. That's more
true
than idiosyncratic.
That is a terrible provision, and if any of us, I think, had been involved at that time, we wouldn't have let our client sign this. But
why would we think that the parties intended that? Because it doesn't make sense.
Well, I mean, couldn't the argument be made that the provision would say that, so that if somebody else started off pro se, the other side would need to be pro se? It's like, you know, we don't want to escalate the thing.
Well,
we're not going to pay for people to escalate this.
Let me address that pro se argument, Justice Gellman. I think, and this comes to one of my major arguments that I'll get to in a moment, if a party engages an attorney to enforce the provisions hereof, and then the important word, or to secure performance under the terms hereof stated, look at the end of the clause. The clause says you can get your fees incurred in enforcing this agreement. That's what their argument focuses on. And or securing performance of the terms herein stated. The entire defense of this case was based on securing performance of the terms of the agreement. The whole case was about varying the terms of the agreement. Forget the word enforcement for a minute. Okay? This case started out with a request for an injunction to enjoin a board of directors meeting that afternoon, which was going to reject what the court ultimately found was a non-qualifying offer. The contract says you've got to accept an offer that's $20 million, a number of other provisions, and it's not a qualifying offer if it's made by or on behalf of a party. First offer comes in, it's signed by his client, has his client's home address as the company's home address. We don't accept that. The first complaint is you must accept this offer. That is an attempt to force us to do something the contract does not require us to do. And our defense, when that lawsuit is filed, is that we are going to, quote, secure performance of the terms of the contract, which don't require us to accept that offer.
It's secure performance by a defaulting party.
Only at the top. And that addresses Justice Goodwin's issue about if the other party takes a lawyer in. The other party can be trying to secure performance. But we don't have to worry about that first top because somebody filed a lawsuit purportedly to enforce the provisions of the agreement. So that's the first clause. That's met. We think our defenses were enforcing it, but certainly he filed a lawsuit, and if he had won, he would have asked for his fees.
So you're not saying that every defendant in a breach of contract case is defending the case in a way that we would call securing performance by a defaulting party?
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that distinguishes this case from virtually all of the lower court other state cases that are cited in the reply brief. For example, in the case out of, I believe it's the case out of...
Counsel, when the trial court basically told the plaintiff that they could no longer pursue the qualifying offer part of their complaint, didn't the complaint really turn into a, you are impeding my ability to run the company, which sort of takes the force away from your argument that they were securing performance of the agreement? The complaint took on a different complexion.
Well, it didn't after the first amended complaint, because the first amended complaint was the exact same thing. You should have took the second order. The second amended complaint, which is what we went to trial on, was not you should have took the first and second offer, but the pleadings against my client were, she was accused of, quote, resistance to high net worth individuals who wanted to purchase the company. That's the first three offers, which are not qualifying. And that she, quote, thwarted the first, second, and third attempts to purchase, which are those offers. And at trial, repeatedly, time and time again, even though those offers were held to be non-qualifying, Mr. DeCesar tried to get them in to the case. Now, we had to object, but we were objecting in order to secure performance to the contract, to the terms of the contract. And even after the trial was over, and we won, Mr. DeCesar filed a motion to have us, for example, under this attorney's fees provision, pay his $150,000 fees incurred in successfully defending a lawsuit filed by the company to which we were not a party against him about a Florida house. He said that was what this fee provision meant. We, my 75-year-old maiden aunt who doesn't own any of the stock, she's an unpaid trustee living in a walk-up in Chicago, that we had to pay his fees for a lawsuit filed against him by the company under this agreement. We had to defend against that motion in order to enforce the terms of the agreement. There we were enforcing the terms, the limitations on the fee provision. Also after trial, he filed a motion to have us, I identify too much with her, to have Ms. Godoy removed from the board of directors, even though she won every single claim. We had to oppose that in order to, quote, secure performance of the terms, unquote, of the agreement. Because one of the terms of the agreement is that we had to remove ourselves from the board of directors if we thwarted the sale. Well, the jury found we didn't. And they filed a motion to kick us off anyway. That was action that we were required to take to secure performance of the agreement. Another post-trial motion. Sorry, it gets so cold.
You mean to say those responses to those motions are securing your client's rights under the agreement?
They are securing performance of the terms of the agreement.
But performance by the defaulting party? How is the defaulting party? Well, first off, who is in default? And how are you securing performance of the party in default?
The only place that default makes a difference, Your Honor, is in that first initiation of a lawsuit. The last clause My colleague said there were four clauses, four requirements. The first is the initiation of a lawsuit by somebody with a lawyer to enforce or secure performance by a defaulting party. That clause is met. That's the only place we're talking about defaulting party.
I mean, but the first fork in the road is, does the prevailing party in the second clause refer to the initiating party in the first clause? I mean, that's the most important.
It can't, because if that's what the contract wanted to do, it would say that party, if a prevailing party. Or it would say, as lots of statutes do and lots of contracts do, the prevailing plaintiff. But it doesn't say that either. It's not limited. It says the prevailing party, not the prevailing party who sued, not that prevailing party, not such prevailing party, but the prevailing party, not even the prevailing plaintiff. So we know it's not limited to a prevailing plaintiff. Just let me, if I may, mention one more thing. One more clause we had to secure compliance with afterwards is that this thing, this contract, the whereas clause says, let's sell this within 18 months. This contract expires within 2 years. Even after we won everything at trial and got a complete defense verdict, we had to oppose a motion for injunctive relief against our client to extend her being subject to this agreement for 2 more years. In other words, we had to secure performance of the clause in the contract, paragraph 10, that made it expire. Now, there are other contract cases where the defendants are not securing performance of the contract, and a number of them are cited in the brief. For example, the Champaign Housing Authority case, where the claim was made that someone was making their apartment a mess. They did not defend by saying, the contract gives me the right to make this a mess. They defended by saying, no, it wasn't a mess. Okay? In that case, well, yeah, maybe to enforce, you have to bring the suit. But not here. Here we are defenders of the contract. We are enforcing the contract, and we are forced to do it. Now, if the contract were written differently, and it said the prevailing plaintiff gets fees, or that prevailing party gets fees, or such prevailing party gets fees, and that's what they have to win, that this means. They have to win that. But if that's what the contract means, then what does that mean for my client? When her, and this is her nephew, when her nephew starts making noises about the way he doesn't like the company being run, is my 75-year-old maiden aunt supposed to come from Chicago, run to the courthouse, and file suit first?
But under your first take on this clause, you still keep your fee award irrespective, if I understand your first take, irrespective of any conclusion we might have that defending the lawsuit was not enforcing the provisions or securing performance, right?
I believe that's how Judge Rausch read it, yes.
Okay, well, were you arguing for that?
I argue that Judge Rausch is always right.
Okay.
I do that all the time.
So there really are two levels to your argument. Number one, I don't need to show securing performance or enforcing provisions because I just won and someone else filed a suit seeking those things. And two, if I need to show it, I have shown it.
Number two, if I need to show that we were enforcing, we were enforcing. Number three, even if we weren't enforcing, we were securing performance of the terms. Now, maybe those are very close concepts, but they are joined by an or. So we win if we do either of them. So if there is some semantic difficulty with the term enforcing, and remember, the primary definition of the term enforce is under a tab that I took out. The primary definition of the term enforce is to give force or effect to. And under that definition, Black's Law Dictionary definition number one, we are giving force and effect to the provisions of the contract, the ones that say we don't have to quit our membership of the board of directors, we don't have to roll over for his mother or sister being thrown off, which is other post-trial relief he asked based on the $1 damage award and $500,000 attorney fee award he got. We don't have to extend the contract for 2 years. We don't have to do all of these extra contractual things. We are defending the contract. We are giving force and effect definition, Black's Law Dictionary, quote-unquote, giving force and effect to the provisions of the contract, and that's why we win. Not that the contract's invalid.
Counsel, where in your... I'm sorry, did you finish answering Justice Ellison's question?
Your Honor, I would go on forever if allowed.
Where in your brief do you make this argument about securing enforcement or securing the contract as opposed to enforcing the contract? I see that you put the language in there, but as I read your brief argues to us that your client was enforcing this contract, and now I'm hearing you argue for the last 10 minutes about securing performance of the terms. Where do I see that argument in the brief?
It would have been more distinctive in the brief had any of the cases that were cited in the reply brief about the definition been in the original brief, which they weren't. But on page 2, for example, we say her actions were necessary to give force to the terms of the agreement, and that's the language of the contract on page 13.
But that's enforcing. I understand you today to be making an argument, well, she really wasn't enforcing it, she was securing performance.
She was doing both.
Where did you make the argument of securing performance in your brief?
Well, it's the title of the section 1 of the brief. It says we are enforcing and securing performance.
And does your argument within that section support both of those propositions?
I believe there's text to page 17 that supports that, page 13 that supports that, reference to page 2, and the title of the sole heading of the argument on page 14 all use those terms. But the distinction is immaterial. It's also enforcement. My time has expired. If there are no questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Doesn't prove a poor choice, but yes. Just briefly, going back to the pro se, the notion that of only awarding attorney's fees to attorneys, I don't think is unusual or strange. I think I would venture to guess that most trial judges would not even consider awarding a pro se litigant attorney's fees if they
The problem with the pro se hypothetical is if it's interpreted to mean what the appellees are saying it means, the appellants are saying it means, then a defendant who wins the case doesn't get their actual incurred fees when the case is filed against them pro se. It just seems peculiar. I've never seen anything like that.
I see what you're saying. Yes. Okay. I don't need to make the rest of my points on that then. I think, though, that what my colleague is saying, though, I think taking a step back, securing performance or enforcing to the questions about default or putting somebody into compliance, in order to secure performance or to enforce, it already suggests that somebody's out of compliance and needs to, that the status quo is not right under the contract, and you've got to restore the status quo. You've got to act somebody, compel somebody to do something that they're not doing. That's what the cases from the other jurisdictions suggest, and I believe also what Judge Lee had in mind in the case that I cited from the Eastern District. They say that if you're just seeking to preserve the status quo, that's not securing performance. That's not enforcing, and I understand that at times the distinction can be fine, but it's still an important one that Mr. Bredehoff's client, Mr. Gale's client, never sought to have Ron DeCesar take an act or not do an act or perform something or pay a dollar or do anything. They just said, we're defending, and you can't do to us something, but we're not going to ask that the court ask you to do something. So I think that's a critical difference. And I think that the notion that this court, that this case presents an excellent opportunity for the court to define a lot of what is probably ignored, what may already be there in some cases, but is often ignored by trial courts in terms of the elements of a fee recovery and having to put your proof on for every element strictly. And the notion that if we're going to have trial courts now decide what's defending and enforcing, when is defense enforcement and when is defense not enforcement, strikes me as an invitation to muddle this whole area unnecessarily and inject needless confusion to what could otherwise be a very bright line rule that's already filed in other jurisdictions as set forth in our cases.
Do you think that this language is going to be a boilerplate? Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't go that far. But I do think there are elements of it that do appear regularly, like the wording. Securing performance that when this decision comes out will provide important guidance. And obviously, our position is that it should be what I think is a bright-line rule that's suggested by the case law and by the facts of this case itself. So unless there are other questions, I'm very grateful to have been here, as I said before, and thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll call the next case.